Hey everyone, I have a question. Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, awesome, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have a ton of cool features like curated podcast lists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but our new members-only version of The Professor Is In podcast is only available on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download it, check it out, and keep an eye out for our members-only content.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of The Professor Is In podcast. I am Dr. Karen Kelski.
And I'm Kel Weinhold.
And we are so glad you're here with us today. We love doing a podcast, don't we?
Does that mean we like talking to ourselves?
We're talking to people.
It is true. I imagine you out there thinking about this. I imagine all the hundreds of clients that I've worked with try to think about what they're worrying about, what they're thinking about, what they've struggled with. So yeah, I'm talking to all y'all.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know when and where you are listening to us.
Oh yeah, on Facebook Live, we used to ask that all the time.
Oh yeah. Well, not just your geographical location. That's what we used to ask on Facebook Live. But are you walking the dog? Are you on the treadmill? Are you on a long drive? Are you going to where you're adjunct, driving to where you're adjuncting?
Do we talk you to sleep at night? Somehow I doubt it, since we start off with such terrorizing and terrifying thoughts.
Publish!
Let's look closely at why you feel like you're not enough. Yeah, there's a bedtime story I've always really wanted to hear.
Very soothing.
So along those lines of terrifying, we're going to transition a little bit from the conversation last week about not feeling like you're enough into the culture of overwork and, not surprisingly, how that feeling feeds it. But let's talk about overwork first.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, how to resist it.
Right.
We're not just going to talk about the culture of overwork so that you can all continue to overwork.
Right.
We're going to talk about the culture of overwork so that you cannot overwork. Let's see how many times we can use the word overwork.
Are you sure that we don't want to just teach them how to effectively overwork? Yeah. I'm positive. I want you. Here's my core belief. And I know this is true because I've talked to lots of clients who have applied the techniques from my productivity course who really do this. But it is absolutely possible to work a 40-hour week most weeks, not all weeks. Sometimes you got to do a little bit extra, but to work a 40-hour week and be successful. I had a conversation last week with the head of a department about how she had taken Unstuck when she was on the tenure track, and now she's head of department and she still works a 40-hour week.
Yeah, we met someone at the American Academy of Religion, sat down and got to have lunch with them and heard the same story.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, amazing.
So it is absolutely possible.
It
so that's
possible.
What we're going to talk about today. First, we're going to talk about the culture of overwork and how it gets created. And then we're going to talk a little bit about how to back off from it, resist it, control
the temptation.
Yeah. Control the temptation. Mm. And remember that you actually like things besides your research.
Remember that you like things. Well, remember you like your, well, I'm not going to say you like your research, but remember that you got into the PhD because you liked something about the world of scholarship too. Mm-hmm. Remember, maybe this isn't the message that you're aiming for right now, Kel, but I just want people to recover their joy.
No, I think that comes from a reasonable and healthy practice. You can actually get back to joy.
Yeah.
What I want people to work toward first is neither joy nor misery, just that it just is. Mm-hmm. And when it becomes a thing that you do, when work becomes a thing that you do instead of this torture or this great elation because someone accepted an article.
Right.
And instead it detaches and it becomes a thing that you do, it makes space for joy.
Or it's a thing you do, it's not who you are.
Oh yeah, that.
So separating it from your identity.
We can do a whole podcast.
A whole podcast. In a way, today's podcast is, I think, a little bit about it. And so was last week's. Because a lot of it, not good enough or overwork, is about this is all I am. I am this job not having that distance from it, that I am myself. This job is a thing that I am choosing to do right now.
Yeah. And we see that happen all the time in people when people are applying for jobs and that they get so caught up in that this job, getting this job is me and it's a sign of my worth.
Right.
and understanding that it's a sign that you were a good fit or you weren't a good fit, right, or you had a good interview or you didn't have a good interview,
right,
but
right,
it's not you, right, not your inherent self that's flawed or less than.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So anyway, yeah. So last week was all about the not enough message that you get from the academy, and it leads naturally to overwork, which is you haven't done enough, so you better do more. I mean, it is like two sides of the same coin, and you get it, you hear it from your own advisors. Sometimes some of you have toxic advisors or toxic department heads who are, you know, explicitly or implicitly telling you to spend more hours in the office and more hours in the lab. I mean, out on social media, where I live much of my life, there is on Twitter, there probably once a month, there's some guy, always a guy, usually from the STEM field, who comes on and says, if you're not working an 80-hour week, you don't have what it takes and you're not committed enough. And of course, there's the usual chorus of outrage and the self-righteous articles and columns and blog posts about how that's a toxic norm. But the fact is it just keeps being the toxic norm.
Right. Well, it becomes a toxic norm until enough people set the rules differently and people get in charge who say, no, that's not the way we're going to do it.
Right.
So it's, you know, sort of, I think in, if you want to talk about our secret squirrel goals, is that we can get to academics when they're young and reset their expectations. So when they move into places of leadership that they can say, no, we're not going to do that.
And I just want to say that just about a month ago, I had a great long hour-long conversation with one of my very, very first clients at the Professor's Inn back from 2011, who is now a soon-to-be tenured faculty member running her own lab, a big dynamic lab funded with millions of dollars. And she could not wait to tell me all the ways that she's imposing these Professor's Inn-inspired policies in her lab, which is like everybody goes home at 5. Everybody takes, you know, lunch, a good solid lunch break. Everybody, we celebrate one another's successes. Everybody, you know, we talk about what we do outside of work. And it's just, it was so exciting.
Yeah.
So I think, we have a, so our plan to take over the world is...
Continues apace.
Continues apace. Yeah. But, you know, the other thing, you were the one to point it out when we were talking about this topic, that it isn't just the academy. I mean, we're a particular, it's a world, right? Particularly intense vortex of it. But right now in neoliberal global climate catastrophe, whatever world that we're in, downsizing, income inequality, billionaire dominated world, that we live in a world of not enough.
Right. There's this whole gigantic culture of
scarcity.
Of scarcity, right? So well, the first place I really started reading about this on an academic level was looking at the work of Brené Brown, who is works in the University of Houston Graduate College, particularly in social work, the College of Social Work. And her research for the last eons that she'd been doing it has been around, in particular around vulnerability, but how she wanted to look at why some people were resilient and why other people weren't resilient. And she really wanted it to, she tells some really great stories about how she really wanted it to be that you were more resilient if you were more tough and if you just endured and if you just sort of kept punching. And she was really, really unhappy to find out that the key to resiliency is actually vulnerability, which I can feel the shiver go out across the land as we talk, we say that. But so she talks about in her book, Daring Greatly, about how she quotes someone else about this world culture of scarcity, that we wake up in deficit, right? Mm. So what's the first thought as you're waking up, as you get up? I didn't get enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have enough time to exercise, have breakfast, do this, right? I don't have enough time.
Didn't I accomplish yesterday?
I didn't get this done yesterday. I can't, you know, it's everything from the minute we wake up to the minute we go to bed. When I didn't go to bed early enough, every single thing is viewed through a lens of deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And where the academy used to have a really kind of stranglehold on this idea.
Yeah, it's true.
Right? It's culturally expanded to all of us sort of constantly feeling inadequate. And I think if you flip over and look at that within the academy, and you probably can in the whole world, but if we just look in the academy, that scarcity mentality, not enough mentality leads to, you're like, you want to be the best in not enough.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Competing in the scarcity competition.
Scarcity competition.
Yeah. Like, the whole entire University of Illinois was one giant scarcity competition. Well, oh, I only slept 6 hours last night. Well, I only slept 4 hours last night. Well, I only slept 2 hours last night.
I have so much grading. I don't have any time to have coffee with you. I have so much to do, where I have all these articles. So the more weight you have on your shoulders, the more your struggle, the more important you are.
Right.
She has a great line in the book. I wish, in Daring Greatly, wish I could quote it exactly, but it's...
Well, it starts in grad school, you know, just like everything else does. Well, I mean, it starts because it's in the air we breathe right now in the United States in 2020 now. We're recording it in 2019, but this will be playing in 2020. Mm. How fun is that? Anyway, yeah, so 2020 U.S. and globe is, you know, scarcity is the air that we breathe. But, you know, then in terms of the academy, which is what we are really concerned with, it's in grad school and the advising that you get from over advisors who overwork and cultures of competition with other grad students. And then, you know, also, especially if you are someone from a marginalized subject position, you're going to have this explicit or implicit message that you've got to do more. You've got to work twice as hard to get a quarter of the credit. And so that you have even less scope, you know, where some white guy is going to, you know, be able to walk in and say, yeah, you know, I took the weekend off and just decided to kick back and binge watch, you know, The Good Place. It's going to have a whole other set of impacts on you if you are a Black woman. So, you know, that level of disclosure. So, you know, the message, the outcomes are very, very distinct. And then it goes on. If you're, you know, you finish and you have a stint as an adjunct, I don't even like to think what the culture of overwork is like for adjuncts in terms of that level of psychic distress on top of hours and hours of work. Mm-hmm. And then if you're on the tenure track, like Cal, you always say, it's like drinking from a fire hose.
Right, especially your first 2 or 3 years is really, it's, you know, you... And I think it's interesting. We've talked about this before, Karen, there keeps being this myth that it's going to be better. Mm-hmm. When I get out of graduate school, I'm not going to be overworked. When I get tenure, I'm not going to be overworked. When I make full, I'm not going to be overworked. And at every one of those places, the ante gets upped. There's more that's added on.
It does. It's the famous story of I think I can safely say every associate professor I've talked to, certainly a woman, associate professor, is I thought it was going to get easier and it got so much harder because I didn't realize how much I was being protected from service. And now all of that service has come barreling down on me and I have to chair every committee and all of this other stuff.
Right. And I think the place that we can look at is that phrase, I have to.
I knew you were gonna take issue with that the minute I said it.
Well, it's good though, because I think that's the way most people think, because I have to. Somebody asked me to, so I have to.
Mm-hmm. Or nobody else is gonna do it, so I have to.
Or I'm gonna be the only one of me. If I'm not there, there's nobody representing, you know, there's nobody representing faculty of color, there's nobody representing women, there's nobody representing
queer
voice, you know, there's nobody representing all three of those. If you live in all those categories, if you live at that intersection. So really, I think that there's a pressure to take these things on, but there's also an internal responsibility. So if we walk into the day in deficit, and then we go into campus and somebody asks more of us, and that then asks more of us, and students want more of us, and everybody wants more of us, pretty soon we're running on fumes. Mm-hmm. And when you're running on fumes, for most women in particular, you sacrifice yourself. You sacrifice your own well-being, your own mental health, your own everything out of this responsibility to a larger whole. So the question becomes, how do you begin to identify where you're overworking and where you can back out of it? And let me be clear here when I start talking, because we're going to go on and we're going to talk about getting out of things and saying no to things. Sometimes this can take a while. It can take like a year to extricate yourself from all the overcommits.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right? So it's really not an instant fix.
And it's not a one-time only fix.
No,
not at sometimes all. You say no to something and then they just come back and say, yeah, well, that doesn't work for me. So I'm going to need you to do it anyway. And then you have to say no again and say no again. And we have a story about that, a person we got to have lunch with in Scotland, I think it was, telling us about saying no to an obligation and saying, oh, I'm sure it's going to be fine. I'm sure it's going to be fine. He's such a nice guy. She was a young woman. You know, agreed to edit something, edit a special issue of a journal or something like that. And she said, oh, you know, he'll be fine. He's such a nice guy. He's always been so supportive. I'm sure it'll be fine. And Kelly said, not sure. He's going to be so nice once you cross him, young woman. Mm-hmm. And we said, hey, so tell us how it goes, okay? And we left, and a couple days later, she sends an email and says, well, you guys were right. He was not nearly the nice guy he was when I was doing what he said and being docile. And he got turned into kind of a jerk. And we basically coached her through the kind of language that you use to say no to something, which getting a little ahead of ourselves, but why don't we just go with that? Why don't we
talk about how to say
yeah,
no?
Yeah, some role playing.
Well, let's set up a couple of examples where people say yes when they shouldn't be saying yes. Because here's the thing. It's a tightrope. It depends on where you're working. It depends on what the expectations are. There's always a tension between, especially as an early academic, saying no to things and then not ending up building the relationships that you need to for your support for tenure. I would say that most people overdo it in the other direction. They have to befriend the world. But
they think they have to befriend the world, and they don't, and they end up, and especially women, you having been trained to say yes to things and make nice, will not say no.
Well, and I think we need to clarify that. I think that it diverges depending on race. I think white women are really trained to protect and take care of and nurture and
white men.
Right, support the patriarchy unconsciously, support white supremacy. I think that women of color, black women in particular, are feel compelled or are pushed to be on a lot of things because they're going to be the only one there.
Right, right.
And so not being there for students, not being there for that voice becomes a whole other complicated thing. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure that we understand that this just depends on where and who you are.
A lot of variables that we can't really go into without grinding ourselves down into
a halt.
To a halt. But let's just say that here you are. Let's take a paradigmatic example. As you are a young woman on the tenure track at a Research One institution, and you're in year four, and you have got to finish your book manuscript and get it into the press so that it is in press and published by the time your tenure file goes in, because that is the requirement. It is black and white. There is not variable. If you don't do it, you will not get tenure. And this is reality for tenure cases in the humanities at R1 and elite institutions. And so you're sitting there and you've got to get it done and it's not done. And then in the midst of this, the department head calls you into his office and says, hey, we just got some money from the dean's office to support the dean's new pet project on translational research. And so I just want you to organize a major symposium using that money and invite 25 people to campus. And can you do that for me, please?
And here's where you're going to change probably the way that you operate. You're going to say, thank you for inviting me to do that. I need to consider my schedule and I'll get back to you in 24 hours.
Yeah, good point. That's not what I was going to say. I was going to go right into the no. But you know what? I like yours better.
Well, first of all, I think that should be your standard response to anybody asking you to do anything. Anybody. Mm-hmm. Anybody. Will you come to this meeting? Will you be on my committee? Will you be anything? That training ourselves to say, you know, I need to look at my commitments, but I'll get back to you within 24 hours.
I need to consult my schedule, but I'll get back to you tomorrow.
I need to look at my publishing plans for this year. I'll get back to you tomorrow. So with the dean, if you say something, I need to look at my publishing plans for this year and I'll get back to you tomorrow, is saying very clearly, I need to prioritize my tenure, but I'll look at it. So give yourself...
It's the department head, by the way. The money came from the dean's office,
right,
but it's the department head.
It doesn't matter whether it's a department head or an undergrad, like, who comes and says, will you be on my honors thesis committee?
Right.
Your answer is still the same.
Answer. I have to consult my schedule. I will get back to you about this tomorrow.
Right. Then one of the things that Brené Brown talks about is the way that you deal with these kinds of cultures that are have created the scarcity mentality is remember how I said the key to it was vulnerability. It's beginning to get a crew of people around you who you can talk to about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And this is where we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but this is where you can use that group. And what we've had clients for years call it is having a no committee. Mm-hmm. So that means that you have a committee of people. I think it works best when you have a committee of people who are at the same rank that you are or very close. You don't want super senior people because they'll make you overpromise, and super junior people will make you overpromise too because they're still like, do anything they say. So you really try to find people in your own on your own level, and then you take it to your no committee and you say to the dean offered, the chair wants me to do this and blah, blah, blah. Now, if you've been meeting with your no committee regularly, they know your book has to be out by the end of the year. So they're going to ask the hard questions. They're going to say, where are you on your book? Mm-hmm. How much time do you have left to do? How many hours do you think you'd have to devote to this? So find a no committee or a supportive committee that asks you questions instead of telling you what to do or reacting. Mm-hmm. But then you can go back and say, having thought it out, having consulted people who have your best interests at heart, and say, thank you. And here's the wording. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I really look forward to working with you at another time. But right now, my publishing schedule just does not allow it. I have a monograph deadline of January 3rd.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's it.
That's it.
No, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I really, thank you so much. That would have been great.
I feel so bad.
Maybe I could find someone for you. Maybe I could do it like halftime. Maybe I could,
right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I can't tell you how many negotiating clients I'm working with right now who are in these scenarios where I work out not just with new jobs, but with people renegotiating their current positions. And there are these scenarios where it's like, well, I know that in 2 years, I'm going to take over the directorship of this particular program. And when I asked the current director about it, they said, oh, yeah, that's going to be in addition to your regular duties. But the current director isn't doing it in addition to other regular duties. The current director is doing it full time. And then there's the full time job that the person's doing. But somehow they think this person, a woman, of course, is going to do both of those jobs and just roll over,
right,
and say, yeah. And there's not even, in the case I'm thinking of right now, not even a raise associated with it. So, you know, there are so many, you know, people who are exploiting you don't walk in and say, hey, I have a thing to exploit you with. So how about we talk about this way that I'm going to exploit you? They don't do that. They say, this is going to be so good for you. You're going to get so much out of this. Well, you're a team player, aren't you? Well, the program really needs you. You're the best person. Nobody could do this as well as you can. The students really need you. And they're going to know all your buttons to push. And flattery, mostly.
Right. And I don't know that we can even say that they're trying to exploit you. What they're trying to do is solve one of their problems. So they have a problem that they need to solve.
Right.
And you would be the solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. The question for you is, will it benefit me?
Right.
Will it move me forward? And right. I don't mean in the super selfish kind of like, it's only all about me. What I mean is, it can't be only all about them.
It
has to have some kind of balance.
Exactly. Is the cost?
Which is why you need that 24 hours.
Right.
To write down the pros and cons.
Yes.
So, for example, we could go back to that thing about, hey, the dean has this money and he wants us to do a seminar, so I'd like you to do it this way. And, you know, you can go back. You can go back with a flat no, or you can also go back with a negotiation.
Yeah. Right.
Saying, you know, I'm happy to do that. If you give me the next semester off to finish my book, I can absolutely do that.
Yeah.
So you can go back and negotiate if you want to do them both.
So true. So true. And that is, I mean, I just have to say it. First of all, academics in general don't go there. They don't think that way. But boy, women sure don't. Mm-hmm. Wow, they sure don't. Mm-hmm. And they'll just be like, okay, yeah, sure, I guess I can add that on top of my 57 other things I'm doing. And it's like, no, you're asking me to do this thing because you want to get in good with the dean and take up his pet project of translational research? That's fine. Then release me from both of my spring courses just so I can finish my book.
Right.
And then I can absolutely do that come fall.
Right. So I think that there are ways that you can, because you might find that that seminar is really a benefit to you.
Symposium, yeah.
Symposium, sorry.
This is hypothetical, but I like to be consistent.
This thing that Karen made up.
This thing. You're not representing accurately. Well, only because symposium sounds like it's a much bigger hassle than a seminar, but that's just me. Whatever. Anyway.
Well, I can say from having planned those things where you have 10 people come to campus from all over the country to talk about something.
Yeah.
I don't care if you call it a seminar, a symposium, a conference, an institute, a weekend gathering. They're just a shit ton of work.
Mm-hmm.
So just really, but it can be very good for you. So that's what I'm trying to say is that I don't want you to swing wildly to the other side of like no to everything because it doesn't serve you in terms of relationships with your department, mm-hmm. but also learning to negotiate
mm-hmm.
what works for you. And that really has to be the question that drives everything. Does this work for me?
Right. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm just supporting what you just said, but if your book is finished, you know, it may be a marvelous use of your time to do a symposium because, gosh, you're going to come into contact with 25 people, three of whom may end up being tenure letter writers for you. You don't know this. That's not a thing you discuss explicitly with them. But the point is, in terms of career networking, this may be a turning point in your career. So that isn't ipso facto. Just because it's a symposium, bad for you. Is it bad for you in this moment, given the other imperatives you have that are more immediate? Because that's a more longer-term career-building exercise, and the book is your immediate career preservation exercise, because it will keep you employed.
I just want to say one more thing in that just going back to what we talked about before of scarcity. We say yes to things in a scarcity mode because we think we'll miss out on it or it might benefit. So what Karen's talking about is this idea that it could very well serve you. And you could say, when I ask the question, does it work for you? You could say, yeah, it really does work for me. That's fine. What we're saying is don't sell yourself short in that. You can set boundaries that still allow you to do it and finish your work instead of what so many young women do, which is keep backburnering their work for requests that other people make.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to sort of give another example of that really quickly before we pivot on to sort of solutions for it, because I think this affects so many people and it especially affects young women. And that is over devotion to your students and to your grading.
Oh, for sure.
Right. So one of the things that I work with clients to do in grading is to determine how much time you have for grading and then divide that by the number of things you have to grade and only devote that much time to it. Now, this works really well if you figure out your rubric for how you're going to mark the papers or the whatever before you start. But what people do so often is they, especially with writing assignments or any kind of thing, they go in and they act like a line editor. You know, they're commenting every other line and they're changing the words and they're doing all this stuff with papers that, by and large, students don't read mm-hmm. or they barely notice. And you can tell that if you give them a chance for a rewrite and it comes in with the same mistakes, you'll start to learn that lesson. But really saying, these are the key things I'm looking for. They're the only things I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to focus on and not doing all the work for the students. And I had a client once talk about the pedagogy of that, which I thought was so amazing, is that overgrading is a pedagogical failure.
Mm.
That it does not require the student to do the work for her or himself.
Mm.
It basically says, let me do this for you.
Oh, wow.
Instead of asking the question,
mm-hmm.
where were you trying to get here? Or what were you trying to do? Instead, it's like, no, you have to do this, 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 and this, and this. And you devote way too much time for grading. Way too much time. So
yeah.
I just want to start figure out about how to set boundaries around grading. That means assignments that are reasonable for you to grade. Make assignments that are reasonable for the amount of time you want to make
mm-hmm.
do grading.
Yeah.
Then set a timer.
And I mean, and yeah, I get it. Some of you idealists are going to be like, that's the tail wagging the dog. I should have pedagogical principles, not, you know, determine how I teach, not the time I have, determine the pedagogical principles. But sorry, you live in a finite universe with some very fixed requirements for tenure and or for job seeking or wherever you are in your career. And you do have to do this kind of calculation. actually.
Right.
And if you're working with advisors who say this is undignified and careerist or something, they don't, they're not your friend. They're not helping you make healthy reality-based choices within a system of time and space and energy.
Yep.
So here, so on that note, in terms of advisors and your team, your no team of no, your what'd you call it? Panel of no
account or your no
committee, your no committee.
Yeah.
You know, I know that some of you listening are thinking, but I don't have a no committee and I don't have people that I trust. And, you know, that's actually not surprising because that's part of what, of what happens in a shame-based, in a shame and a scarcity-based system is that people, what Brené Brown calls, it's the shame slash comparison slash disengagement dynamic.
Right.
Which is basically because you feel bad and you're busy comparing yourselves in a competitive way to other people, therefore you don't trust them. And you view them as your competitors rather than your friends, and you disengage from them, and that just, and it is an ever intensifying spiral.
Right.
And everybody is doing it. And so, of course, you guys end up without a really close community mm-hmm. within the academy. Mm-hmm. And if you do have a close community, you're very lucky. And I applaud you and feel and go be sure and tell them how much you appreciate them. Because I know that some people are fortunate and do have it, especially sometimes it comes out of grad school. But I think the norm is to not have it.
Yeah, the norm is to arrive at your, in grad school or to arrive at your new position or your adjunct position or whatever and feel as if you're living in that culture of shame. The academy is a culture of shame. The academy is a culture of comparison. So you have two of the three components of what Brown says create that scarcity mentality. Then you have the disengagement, meaning I'm not going to talk to you about those things because there's no place here to deal with that. So you have to create the place to deal with that.
Yep.
You have to create your community. And I was saying to Karen earlier that it reminds me of people who get famous and how they talk about the people that they were close to before they got famous,
mm-hmm.
how critical those people are because they didn't have any investment in their fame. They'll tell them the truth. They knew them back when.
And they're not competitors in, you know,
right.
in Hollywood or wherever it is that the person got so famous.
So making sure that you find that group and keep nurturing that group is so absolutely imperative that you can say, I can trust you to ask me questions. You often can't do that with a partner because you come in with your vulnerabilities and they often either say, oh, you're okay, or oh, stop being like that, right? Like, I mean, they're going to enable you, like, oh, you're fine, it's going to be fine, or oh, you poor baby, they were so mean to you,
or would you just stop with the bitching already?
I'm so sick of the academy. I'm
so sick of hearing about your department and your stupid department head. So spouses are often overburdened in other ways. So they aren't always the best. Sometimes they can be, but generally.
But we often get people around us who do that same sort of enabling behavior, right? Mm-hmm. They even enable our victimhood mm-hmm. by saying, oh, I can't believe he did that to you. I can't believe that was so terrible. That was so mean. Which I don't mean you're not supposed to have people you need to have people who are honoring your experience. It's whether they're feeding that or not.
Mm-hmm.
And honoring it is very different. Saying, wow, that was really hard. What they said to you, do you believe is true? How do you think that that's not who you are? How do you think you're going to move forward? Like, give you some agency, give you some responsibility, but hear you. And that's really the place where you can start to begin to have the security then to come out and set those boundaries again.
Yeah. So to wrap up, basically leaving you with two ideas. The first is to gather the people around you, mobilize the people around you if you already have them, to be your no committee and to ask you those questions and really, force you to look at the places where you are not prioritizing your own well-being. And alongside that, being your own no committee, really saying to yourself, taking that 24 hours in any request, in the face of any request from an undergrad student, from a grad student, from a colleague, from a department head, from a dean. Thank you for the opportunity. I am going to have to consult my schedule, and I will get back to you about that tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then saying, oh, and I'm not sure that we gave language for the actual saying of no, though.
I did. Remember we said, I said, thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, my schedule just does not allow me to do that at this time.
And I look forward to working with you in the future.
Yep.
That would be awesome.
Yep. That is perfect.
And you could even say, I'm available next semester if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to finish this. So they know that you're not just blowing them off. And so you're maintaining those relationships.
Yep. All right. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Bye-bye.